Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm very excited to be talking to someone I've been wanting to talk to for some time now. This is the first time. Dancy Senna is my guest. She is the author of the novel New People. I found it to be a very funny and at the same time disturbing, distressing novel, largely because it has its finger on subject matter that's crucial to the way we're living and thinking and reading and writing now. Your mother is a writer. Your father was a writer.
Yeah.
Your aunt is a writer. Your husband is a writer. And many of these various writers were married in what were then called biracial couples.
Yeah.
So this has always been a subject matter for you, when now it's becoming the subject matter.
It's funny. I like that you said that the book was funny and disturbing, because I think I always am interested in those two emotional states of sort of horror and humor and the relationship between the two. And I think that's the most sort of hilarious things often have a horrifying edge to them, and the most horrifying things can be funny.
One of your books is I think you call it a personal history.
Right.
And at a certain point, midway, I became aware that I didn't know a life that was anything like your father's life in terms of poverty, adoption, suffering, that still led to a man who pulled himself into a different frame of life, became a writer, a kind of analyst of racial America in the 60s. And I thought, wow.
Yeah.
I was so disturbed by where he'd come from. I thought that us Russian Jewish immigrants with our pogroms, and my grandmother had to bribe the Russian army to bring my uncle over here. She had to find him.
Right.
He'd been stolen. But nothing compared to what you were writing about. And again, in your new novel, New People, there's the comedy of race, which you don't expect, and then the sudden seriousness of race.
Right.
The heroine of the novel is a woman named Maria, and she has taken her intended over to what she calls the dark side.
Right.
Tell me what the dark side is.
Yeah, Maria is in college in Stanford in the 90s, or late 80s, early 90s, as I was. And she's of mixed race, but has been raised by her adoptive black mother, sort of very fully to identify as black. And she meets this mixed race guy named Khalil, who's half black and half Jewish. And he's, in her mind, she calls it miscellaneous, this kind of black person who doesn't have any other black friends and is sort of alienated from black culture. And she sees it as her mission to kind of save him from sure tragedy as he's about to, you know, join a fraternity and become what she calls the Hootie and the Blowfish, you know, the one black guy surrounded by a bunch of white guys. And he's got a white girlfriend, and she basically teaches him black culture, and they end up a couple and engaged to be married. And I saw that as all kind of high comedy, but with hopefully a sort of edge to it.
Well, it's got quite an edge, because at a certain point in his learning, He takes a column for the school newspaper in which he writes about what he's discovering about being black as he identifies more and more as a black person. And his girlfriend, eventually his intended, his fiance, disguises her voice, leaves a message on his phone machine saying, "We're going to get you. You don't get to write this kind of stuff. We're going to hang you." And of course, yeah. The entire Black Student Union meets to discuss this, and the dean is woken up in the middle of the night and is asked, "What are you going to do? Are you just going to let this go by?" And the woman who did this by disguising her voice, his girlfriend, can never tell anyone.
Yeah.
There's one person, a lesbian,
a black woman lesbian, her best friend, who knows, who did it with her. And so they played this prank on poor Khalil at the height of his black immersion and, you know, his learning to be black. And they decided high one night, smoking weed, to leave him this awful racist threat by disguising their voices, and it is this secret she carries with her to the grave, kind of. And Jesse Jackson comes to the campus and speaks, and it becomes like a rallying point for the black community, this racist
incident.
Yes,
he becomes a hero.
Yeah, and he becomes a
hero of the black community.
Yeah.
She has inadvertently turned him into a black power spokesman on campus. So we become aware as readers that there's much more to this than, pardon me, a simple black and white perspective.
Yeah.
That all the time people are getting themselves in over their heads and finding the solution in laughter.
Right. And I think she remains throughout the novel, and what interested me about her was that she's kind of sometimes meaning to be and sometimes not meaning to be. She's kind of a trickster, and her character, she's not morally upright. She sort of does things that we cringe at, like leaving this racist message and posing as a nanny and pretending to be things she's not. And it sort of complicates the plot in all these ways. But I really wasn't interested in writing a character who did all the right things. I thought giving her a kind of mix of being both good and bad, as long as she remained interesting, that was the main requirement for me.
Does she do it in part, too, because she thinks it's funny?
Yes. I think a lot of the things she does are just because she thinks it's funny, but there may be an element of hostility to it, too.
Yes. There's an underlying plane of anger because, in addition, she's discovered that despite the fact that she's introduced her husband to be half black, half Jewish, to his black side, to his dark side, she doesn't really love him.
Mm.
She doesn't feel good having sex with him.
Yeah.
She's been more attracted to other people, and she wonders whether she has a crush on white men.
Right.
Because she's enjoyed that more when she's explored it. And the people in the various lives in your book are advised to experiment. That they can't know who they are. That culture is changing so radically that by and large, you can't look at a person anymore and say, black, white, Mexican, Chinese, we're living, the pot melted.
Yeah, long ago. I mean, I was raised, you know, in a different time, and I feel like I'm like the last of the one drop rule people, where I was raised by my white mother and black father to identify as black, and that was the only option for a mixed race person at that time. Whether you looked white or black, if you had a black identified parent, you were black, and the my parents, being as politicized as they were, saw that as a way to instill pride in the part of our identities that would be most attacked. And it's changed so much since then. And there are, you can, you know, see a school form and it has the multiracial category. But it used to be you could just check other, and that was the only other option. And
well,
for
now
Maria,
you say miscellaneous.
Or miscellaneous, yeah. And I think for Maria and Khalil, you know, they're in this moment of this kind of fetishizing of mixed race people in the 90s. And I remember this very distinctly. There was always these cover stories about this new generation and that they were going to bring the country into the future. And this was this beautiful solution to the black-white divide. And Maria's a lot more cynical than Khalil about all of it. And as a person, there's more kind of irony and sort of sarcasm in her relationship to these fantasies or mythologies.
I'm talking to Danzy Senna about her new novel, New People. Now, one of the things that's so exciting about the book is that she is ironic and that we have returned to a moment where there's an enormous earnestness.
Yeah.
About race and how to handle it in novels. Mm. This is a woman who is frequently not recognized visually as black. She has to convince people that she's black. She's politically incorrect.
And that was so delicious and fun for me to write at this moment because I think... you know, I always joke to my students that if you're going to write fiction, you have to kick bell hooks and Judith Butler out of the room before you sit down to write. And I started making that joke at Sarah Lawrence, where most of my students were really seeped in sort of feminist theory. And they would come into my workshop and bring that to their writing process. And it was really crippling. And I had to sort of let them be free in their imaginings. And it couldn't be, you know, controlled by this other kind of language.
Now, first of all, let my listeners know who bell hooks and Judith Butler are.
Bell hooks is a black feminist critic who I love and read in college and think she's brilliant. And she would read, you know, she wrote a bunch of books about feminism and racial politics and very well done. Judith Butler is one of the major, you know, feminist queer theorists who's at Berkeley, I believe. But she's had a big influence on a lot of the students I had. And so they would bring in a lot of this other kind of language that I didn't feel belonged in the fictional realm.
Yes. But you see, with bell hooks, we're talking about race. And with Judith Butler, we're talking about gender. You, in your book, bring a fluidity to race as well. In fact, your husband, Percival Everett, is a writer of great satirical novels in which assumptions about race are taken hilariously to task, but not in order to be forgiven, in order for people to feel the shame associated with assumptions.
Right. Yeah, no, and I think for me, you know, the irony and the humor in here, for me, it only works because I'm aware of the seriousness of race and racism and have never lost an awareness of that. It's been a sort of a relentless thing in my life from the moment I could speak, racial identity, questions of belonging, and racism, of which I've had a lot of exposure to, given that I get that sort of experience of hearing the white liberal discussion when the black person leaves the room or the dinner party when they think that there is nobody black there. So I've had a kind of racism that's sort of secondhand exposure. And I think the character's mother, her black mother, says at one point to her that Maria has the rage of the light skin, the particular rage of the light skinned individual or something. And I was thinking a lot about how a certain kind of rage develops in people who have to constantly explain themselves or have to come out as black in these moments. And for Maria, I think there's the comedy and the rage and that combustible mix, and her sort of tricksterness, her slyness is and crookedness, those kind of qualities all mixed together made for a really exciting fictional space.
Indeed. Because, you know, my fear picking up this book was that it was going to be earnest. I had no idea how outside the pale it is.
If I start reading something and it feels it goes into sentimentality or earnestness, I feel the more transgressive thing is actually the more ironic and multi-layered perspective on these things, and that actually the earnestness kind of, it's where the left kind of quickly circles and becomes the right.
Exactly. And this book becomes very funny because it is inventing a certain kind of Black history. She speaks of the era of the mulatto martyr.
Right.
Now, I never heard of such a thing, and I asked you, and you said...
I made it up. Yeah, there are these very lofty... She sort of will just throw out an era that existed, and it's in all, you know, it's capitalized as if it's, you know, the Dark Ages, or I think there is a Dark Age of mestizo alienation or something. And, you know, she makes up these names for these different eras. And I was interested, you know, because if you're a mixed race person, and I think if you're a Black person as well, you're aware that the changes are happening so quickly that throughout your life, there's a totally different reality that you have that, you know, your children won't have, and that your dad, my father grew up with Jim Crow. And, you know, I was born at the end of the civil rights movement, and my son was born when Obama was being elected. You know, he was walking around wearing Obama t-shirts during the first election. Especially being of the child of a Black person and a white person, history is not an abstraction. It is so much a part of your personal life and everything that occurs on the playground and sort of where you move and who you sit with in the cafeteria. All of those things are defined by these historical events, and it's not separate. And I mean, Jonestown is the other story that kind of weaves itself through this novel. And that, of course, was, you know, the 1978 massacre. 1,000 people drank the Kool-Aid in Guyana in a cult mass suicide. And Maria is studying that as a graduate student.
That's what her dissertation is about.
Yeah. And that they called themselves Another America. And that was the other idea of, you know, a new people, that they were going to go to Guyana and start a sort of multiracial utopia in the 70s.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Danzy Senna about a very exciting book, and controversial, I would say, called New People. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Danzy Senna about her latest novel, New People, a smart read at the intersection of adulthood and identity, love and longing. Now, your mother and your aunt are both known as two of the major living American poets. They are Fanny Howe and Susan Howe. And in this book, there's a poet figure who is represented as an alternative to the dramas of race. He is Mr. Ambivalent, And, you know, from time to time, Maria is called the queen of ambivalence. And poetry seems to be the realm where ambivalence is the preferred mode and earnestness is something, well, ho-hum.
Yes.
So I wanted to know, you have not been a poet, although both your mother and your aunt have written both poetry and prose. Tell me.
I am not a poet because, first of all, it was the only way to distinguish myself from certain family members was to just avoid that completely. But I also am... My first love are novels. I mean, I was just looking at old diaries from when I was 10. They went all the way through my 20s. And I found them in this box in the basement. And from a very, very young age, I just wanted to write and read fiction. And I was always a storyteller. And storytelling is my first love. It's where I go to at dinner parties is telling stories, and it's where how I make sense of my universe. And so for me, the thing, you write what you want to read. And for me, I love poetry, but what I prefer to read are novels. It's always where I want to be.
Now, Danzy, I would say that you're not so much a storyteller as a story breaker. You take the way a poet breaks up the convention of poetry, you break up the conventions of fiction. None of the endings here are the way you expect them to be. Your first book, Caucasia, was a radical book about, you know, black and white America and mixed mm-hmm. races. This book is the most radical book since, but it's become very flippant and flamboyant. It's a wild ride.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the book I felt the most liberated in, New People. I felt finally, and I felt free from the idea of the burden of representation and being sort of beholden to any positive image policing, any kind of political correctness. I felt, for some reason, this character and this moment in my life, maybe it being book five, maybe it's motherhood, something. I felt released from any sense of obligation to anything but the pleasure I was going to have in telling this story and in maybe breaking this story too. But I didn't want to write something that fell into any of the traps that exhaust me as a reader.
This book ends with our character essentially in prison. She's hiding under a bed she shouldn't be under, in an apartment she shouldn't have entered, watching the behaviors of people that she shouldn't know. And it's as if she's in the position that we are all in when we read a novel or when we try to understand life.
Right.
What is life like for other people? Where would I have to hide in order to find out what the secret life of others is about?
Right. And I love the idea that, you know, she ends up in a kind of prison because, you know, what I like in a novel is for it to end a little bit before things are comfortable for me as a reader. And I like a sense of the incomplete and of leaving the reader with the problem and not tying it up for them and leaving it alive in them. And I really sort of shy away from ideas of redemption and progress. I don't trust them. I really don't trust them.
They can't be trusted.
And I don't, and I think, you know, Jonestown for me, you know, is this haunting narrative of, you know, this very beautiful idea becoming its opposite, becoming its the worst, you know, nightmare and holocaust in a way of, you know, a lot of black bodies in the name of a black socialist utopia. So I'm like interested in the way that an idea can be used and language can be used that seems liberationist and is actually oppressive.
Yes, and I would say also that this book preaches the danger of drinking the Kool-Aid. Don't accept received ideas. Don't agree with the death of culture, your own or anyone else's.
Yes.
We're not ready to announce that we're done yet.
Yes.
I mean, whatever we face, there are more adventures between here and the end. And that's what I liked so much about this book. It ends with more adventures to come.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that there's just so much right now in the culture that is, and especially on social media and, you know, this sort of self-righteousness, people feeling very secure in their position that they're on the right side. And that can veer very quickly into a kind of fascism, and that you sort of become the thing that you're arguing against. And, and a couple of people have said, you know, does Maria seem like, they thought she seemed despairing or tragic? And for me, there's kind of a rebelliousness that I was attracted to in her, and that she's responding to things that are in the culture that should be reacted to and resisted.
And that we lack the language right now to respond to, and we fear being attacked.
Yes.
When we try and find that language.
Yeah.
It's therefore, to my mind, a very brave book.
Thank you. I think my little, I wrote it in a kind of secret dream state, and that's, I've decided, the best place to write a novel from, where you don't even know that you're going to publish it. Just write it in your little room alone and amuse yourself and give it to your few closest friends. I mean, as a fiction writer, you know, I think you have to just be willing to take everyone down, and nobody can be sacred. The moment something is sacred, your fiction is really, really in danger.
I've been talking with Dancy Senna, author of New People. It's a novel published by Riverhead Books. It's wild, it's fun, it's funny, and it's dangerous. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from New People at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to birthday boy David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when George Saunders is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.